This is known as the Centre for Contemporary Christianity in Ireland. We're sort of morphing into something like contemporarychristianity.org, which is the website that you probably know about. Our aim is to provide a safe space for conversations, such as we're hoping to have tonight, and to provide biblical reflection on some of the big issues that are out in our society and in our churches, and to allow for space and interaction so that we can be free to question, free to develop our own thinking, and hopefully develop mature habits of thinking and also of action, so that we have lives of integrity with which to influence our churches and our society as a whole for good. Leslie Carroll, Reverend Dr. Leslie Carroll, the Presbyterian minister from Fort William and McCrory in North Belfast. She knows plenty about difficulties faced on both sides of interfaces, both in her congregational ministry and in her role as convener of the Church and Society Committee, the Presbyterian Church. She's had time to reflect upon the big picture of our post-conflict society through her participation. At least I'm assuming she's had time to reflect on it, maybe she'll tell us otherwise, in the Ames Bradley consultative group on the past. Welcome. And so the plan for tonight was to ask Leslie to speak. We'll spend some time listening to her and thinking with her, and she'll share some reflections. I hope possibly some biblical thought in there. She's a good Presbyterian. She will. Will it be three-pointed and alliterated? No.
Definitely not. And,
after about, well, I'm not sure how long, we'll have an opportunity to ask questions and engage with each other in discussion, which I hope will all be enlightening and stimulating for us all, and help us to think about where we are, where we come from, and where we're going. Leslie, I'm going to hand over to you for a future facing the past or something else. Perhaps we should welcome Leslie and say thanks very much for coming.
Especially as if I don't do very well, you'll not be having too many more of these by the sound of it. It's all a bit of pressure, you know. So thanks to Cheryl for the invitation and the opportunity to speak. The biblical bit of this will be a bit like the treasure buried in the ground. You have to dig to find it, but it is there. All right, so I'll do my best with that. Some of you I know, some of you I don't know. See, Trevor arrived there on the group. We call Trevor our groupie because he was there all the way. That didn't mean you agreed with everything, Trevor. It's okay. So some of you made inputs into the consultative group's process, and we very much appreciated that. I'll try, as I go through, not to duck the issues that kind of have made public debate. And really, in terms of the whole report, the issues that have made public debate are so few that it's disappointing. But I'll try not to duck them, but you may think I have, and that's fine. Then please feel free to come back at me at the end of that. And also, there's so much to be said. I've tried not to say too much, so I've no idea how long I'm going to talk till I start. So if it goes too long, kick me, but it's likely to go too short, and in which case I look forward then to your questions, which is always easier to deal with. Let me say something first of all about the group as a group. We were an extremely disparate group of people. Didn't know each other beforehand. I mean, I knew David Porter, yes, better than probably I knew anybody. I knew Dennis Bradley from time to time at things. Beyond that, I'd never drawn breath with the people who appeared in the group, and so that meant we were coming to each other very much as strangers. But even as strangers, we knew that anything that could happen or would happen amongst us as a group was something that could or would happen in the broader society in which we live. And it was therefore important for us all to represent the various constituencies from which we either came or with which we were in touch. There was a lot of debate at the appointment of the group about the representatives on the group and how representative the group actually was. In particular, there would have been discussion about there being no Roman Catholic priest on the group, and also about there being no real representation of victims and survivors. All of us felt that we had connections either into the priesthood or into the victims and survivor community, and we didn't. We felt all we could do was our best at that stage. So I acknowledge that there could be a discussion about the representative nature of the group. From the beginning, it was very clear amongst us that we were taking our task very seriously. None of us were there to win our end of an argument. We were all there to try to discover a way forward, and we knew that. Now, that's not to say there weren't times when we did go for our end of the argument. We did, and we had to, and that was all part of the process and needed to be done. But ultimately, we realised that there was a task much bigger than us and much bigger than any of our individual opinions. And of course, most of us knew at the beginning that the task was immense. I would have to say, I don't know about the rest of them, but I don't think I knew just how immense was. So it was a huge task that we had. I want to kind of speak about the report. I don't know how many of you've read it. First of all, if you've read it, congratulations. because it's I think, hard enough to sit down and read from cover to cover. If you've read the short report, I'm told it doesn't do justice to the main report, and I'm told, because I haven't read the short report, because I did a lot of work on the text of the large report and I couldn't face the short one. So if you've read the short one, you know, maybe it doesn't reflect the whole journey as well as the large one. I'm really not sure. But I want to kind of speak to it using the guiding principles that we laid out in our second chapter, which we called Developing a Roadmap for the Future. And this, it seemed to us, was a really important thing to do and to work with as we went through the process, that we had some touchstones to which we would return, especially if things became very difficult or if we found it difficult to reach an agreement. We needed to have some principles that we went back to, touched base with, and used to help us shape the decision that we were going to take. So it was like setting some kind of standard for ourselves. Now, that's not to say we always achieved the standard, but it is to say we tried to measure what we were doing in some way or other. And the overriding principle of all the other minor principles which flowed from this main one, it was this: the past should be dealt with in a manner which enables society to become more defined by its desire for true and lasting reconciliation, rather than by division and mistrust, seeking to promote a shared and reconciled future for all. Do you want me to read that again? Mm-hmm. Yeah. The past should be dealt with in a manner which enables society to become more defined by its desire for true and lasting reconciliation than by division and mistrust, seeking to promote a shared and reconciled future for all. We realised as we kind of developed that principle, that was about us realising that we had the potential to make things a whole lot worse, depending on what we came up with. And so we were always trying to resist making things worse. Let me repeat, we didn't always meet the challenges, but that was our intention, to hold back on making things considerably worse. And I suppose it became much clearer to us as we went through the process that if everyone continued to lobby for their own constituency with the same vigour in which they lobbied us, then there really wasn't much hope for the future. So really there needed to be some commitment to that redefinition of ourselves by something we aspired to in the future rather than by all that we experienced in the past. And now we were there to be lobbied, so there was nothing wrong with lobbying us. That's what we were there for, and only to be anticipated. But things definitely need to move on from that in some way. The other thing we kind of half knew as we went into the public consultation process, but which we absolutely knew by the end of it, and then by the end of the more private process that we went through after that, we knew that guns may be off the streets, but the conflict isn't over. And as we went on and on through our work, the fact that the conflict isn't over just became clearer and clearer to us. Now, I'm trying here to avoid using the word war. The war is over, but the conflict's not over. I suppose there's a certain frustration in me coming from the unionist side of the fence in terms of background, that we just hate that word war because it would give some credibility to the other side, if you like, and to what was going on. And yet, if only that could have been conceded, so much could have been dealt with in a more swift and a quicker way, and in a way which most people from the unionist community would communicate to us as being, let's end it and get on with the future. If unionists really wanted that, they were going to have to concede the war thing, but there was no desire to concede that at all. So that was one of the frustrations under this guiding principle. If you kind of wanted to move to the future, the ability to look away from the past was constrained by all sorts of things. We came to the increasing conviction that every contentious aspect of the Troubles could not be resolved, and therefore we could only try to resolve what we could as far as possible, and then seek agreement to lay the rest to lay all of the rest to rest. Otherwise we were going to be dogged by the past for generations to come. So we were caught in this kind of trap between the past and the future, but seeking to develop something which would help the finest more by the future than by the past. Maybe with that, when I say that our increasing conviction was that every aspect of, or every contentious aspect of the Years of the Troubles couldn't be resolved, important maybe to say why I think that was. Why could they not be resolved? Well, first of all, there was the issue of truth. Truth is important in the Christian community. We believe in truth. We believe in speaking the truth. We believe in seeking the truth. We believe in telling the truth. But in the world of politics, the truth is that you're simply not going to get the truth. We might get bits of it here and there, but enough truth to piece a whole puzzle together, it's never going to happen. Therefore, the potential to resolve everything from the past is really closed down. Why could it all not be resolved? Truth, but also victims and survivors who are part of us, among us. We are them and they are us, and yet they are apart from us and different from us. And all of that contentious stuff around victims and survivors, it's not possible to entirely resolve, quite simply because it's not possible to completely heal every victim and every survivor. And by that I mean that their lives cannot be made completely right. And for some of them, their lives can't be made even half right. And I don't say that in any kind of patronising way, but I'm trying to acknowledge the difficulties that exist for the victims and survivors community, and trying to acknowledge also the variety of people within that broad community. And this area would have been the most difficult to speak of, because once you try to speak of it at all, somebody's going to get hurt. So for all those reasons, it's practically impossible to resolve all of the issues to do with the past. Another reason for not being able to resolve all of the issues was much more materialistic: money. We have a whole system of inquiries, of appeals courts, of criminal reviews of convictions, all of which cost endless amounts of money, a bottomless pit of money that we spent a long time trying to make some judgments on what the cost of dealing with the past would be if we were to use all the systems that are presently in place, and we were unable to make any judgment on that. Our judgment was that what we've already paid out in inquiries is only the tip of the iceberg. So if things continue as they are, money just simply isn't there. Or it has to be there, because those are legal processes that have to be delivered. And if the money has to go in that direction, then you can be sure there'll be fewer hip replacements, decent roads, new schools, etc., etc., etc. So the investment all becomes into the past and not into the future at all. So that was our best judgment on that one. Another reason why all the issues can't be resolved is the continuing and persistent sectarianism which exists in our society. And I think we can only rise above that with increased trust. And that trust takes some time to build up. I don't know if you heard today the Criminal Justice Inspectorate's report on prisons and the finding. I haven't read it now in any close detail, so I'm working off the headlines here. But the headline was that Catholic prisoners experience more bad treatment than Protestant prisoners, and the kind of analysis in the headline analysis was that there are more Protestant prison officers than Catholic prison officers, and that's meant to explain it. I will go and read it and pick up more of the nuances of it. But I suppose all of that is to say our prison system is as sectarian as any other system in this society. And I would want to say that there is no system in this society that has avoided sectarianism. So that continuing, persistent, and now largely unspoken sectarianism is still there and makes it extremely difficult to completely resolve all the issues to do with the past. So that's all in regard to that first and overriding guiding principle. The second principle that we worked on is that dealing with the past is a process and not an event. In other words, it's one of those elongated miracles rather than one of those immediate miracles. It happens in time and in a variety of ways. And because we're dealing with people, all of whom have been damaged to one degree or another, it doesn't happen with immediacy. So we saw ourselves as part of a process rather than as the people with all the answers. You'll be glad to know that, probably. So the question for us as we went through our work was, what can be done at this time? There might have been all sorts of things we would have liked to have seen done, but the time wasn't right, or it was never going to work, or it was too much pie in the sky. I'll talk a wee bit about one of the pie in the sky things we did in a wee while, but by and large we tried to avoid the pie in the sky stuff. Dealing with the past is a process and not an event, and therefore there may be much more in the future that needs to be done. Specifically, we were recommending a legacy commission to run for 5 years. At the end of the 5 years, we were suggesting that there needed to be a rethink and a regroup and a relook. Not in the same way as we did it, but the commission itself should be looking to propose or to suggest ways forward or to negotiate ways forward. The next principle that arose from that overriding one then is that sensitivity towards victims and survivors is essential. We argued, discussed, debated, scratched our heads for a long time about how to frame this one. Victims and survivors should be central to any process. Victims and survivors should be the focus of any process. This is all about victims and survivors. We ended up with this sensitivity towards victims and survivors is essential. And that was for a number of reasons. First of all, the past is the whole of this society's problem, and not a problem that belongs to victims and survivors. We can't dump it all on them. We can't use them as an excuse for us not to do anything. The problem belongs to everyone, or the past, however you want to say it, belongs to everyone. Yet the suffering that they have endured cannot be ignored or brushed under the carpet. Neither can a community of people which is disparate and various and has different levels of being vocal and different levels of influence within the political world. They can't be allowed to hold everyone to the same bondage that they might find themselves in, or the same hurt that they might find themselves in, or the same difficulties, or even to the same moral standards that they might espouse for themselves. The victims and survivors is a various and not a homogenous community. We do need to see the world through their eyes, and the experience of being at the public meetings that we held was probably how we were able best to see the world through their eyes. We had public meetings in 6 places, and then we had another extra additional meeting in Cookstown with UDR and RIR Widows and their families. And suffice to say, at all those meetings, when anyone from within the broad victims and survivors community spoke, the suffering was palpable. It was also true to say that they were highly politicised, some of them, and that is true for both sides and both sets of experiences. And amongst them also, you would find the simplicity of folk who just wanted some answers to some very ordinary questions, like what was my son doing before he was killed, or where was he going when he was killed? Those kinds of ordinary questions, which then step up to other things like who did it and why did they do it and who was involved in it, etc. We attempted, here we come to one of the things you probably think was a pie in the sky moment or a completely lost the plot moment, an attempt to deal with the politicisation of the victims and survivors community was made by us in a number of ways. The first was in terms of the payment of the £12,000, which now is completely off the table, so it's never going to happen, but I still feel I need to offer some explanation of it. There is no way forward unless we can look each other in the eye. And this was to enable us to look each other in the eye. And for some people to be able to feel looked in the eye for the first time and say that their suffering was recognised or acknowledged. That wasn't, I don't mean by that it was justified, or what their son might have been doing when he went out to do whatever he did, or their daughter. Not to justify evil doing or badness or anything like that, but to look somebody in the eye as a fellow human being. I think for us the other aspect of the 12,000 was quite simply when you saw people and listened to people and heard what they had to live with and heard what they had to live without, we just wanted to do something. Now it was ham-fisted, awkward, all of that, but it was an attempt to just do something in the face of human suffering. That was one attempt to deal with the politicisation. We were very well aware that the Victims Commission was in place and that this is one of the issues that will confront them as they go through their work. And so we had some conversations with them about where we were going and how we could be supportive of them and where they were going, and that again was an attempt to address the politicisation issue. We also attempted to deal with that politicisation of the victims' survivors' community through recommending that there would be more coordinated funding amongst the groups so that the funding wouldn't perhaps be so piecemeal. And we also, by trying to keep the justice route open through the Commission in the review and investigation strand, attempted to address that politicisation and the political needs of some of the victims and survivors. I would have to say we then balanced that by trying to address the more ordinary questions that some victims and survivors had through the information recovery process, so people might get some of the story that they wanted to hear without having to go through something that would take them towards a conviction. So that's dealing with the past as a process and not event, sensitivity towards victims and survivors. Recommendations should be human rights compliant. Well, that's there because it had to be. Everything has to be these days. But we wanted, and I think the Christian community quite simply hasn't got its head around this whole human rights stuff at all, and there's a massive challenge for us here. Mostly we torture ourselves on the human rights stuff, and we torture ourselves by lobbying for ourselves and by saying they shouldn't get that, or if they're getting that, who's looking after us? We'd better look after ourselves, which is to totally undermine where human rights ever came from in the first place. So this whole notion needs to be redeemed, I think, and the Christian community needs to find some way to redeem it for itself, because it came out of Christian roots after all. But we wanted to try to kind of take the sharp edge of the human rights compliance stuff by arguing that a society has the right to live peaceably with itself, alongside all those kind of individual rights that people lobby very strongly for in our world today. And we were therefore very well aware that some of the things we would propose would need derogation from Europe, and they would need legislation in Westminster in order to meet the human rights standards, or in order to allow us off completely meeting the human rights standards. Again, I have to say, we could have been let off a considerable amount if we could have conceded there was a war, but we weren't going to concede that as a society. Our next kind of guiding principle was that relationships matter and are the foundation for reconciliation. What we meant by that is that a society should best be defined by the potentials it envisages for the future. Now, that was going to require a somewhat changed society, and so we proposed that there would be a society strand to the Legacy Commission which would look at how this society is, what still dogs us from the past, and what needs to be addressed. Now, there's still a considerable amount of work. We know we just ran out of time, essentially. This could have gone on for another year, but it needed to be ended. So there's still work that needs to be done around what precisely the society issues are. Some of them are very clear. The sectarianism is very clear. The education about the past and handling conflict in the future, that's kind of clear. The trauma provision and the provision for victims and survivors in terms of mental, physical health issues, particularly as they age, all those society issues are kind of clear, but there still needs to be some work done on what other issues are there. And the storytelling, the remembering, all of that still needs to be worked through. Therefore, we proposed alongside this society strand a reconciliation forum which would work with the Victims Commission in developing some of these society issues. Again, we were very aware that the Victims Commission were beginning to look at some of the same issues as we were, and there's no point. I mean, one of the things we were trying to do was to coordinate and not to duplicate. So there was no point if we knew that the Victims Commission were going to be doing things of us suggesting the same things, but we did want to kind of hold it together with them. So relationships matter, and how this society is in relationship with each other matters too. Next principle, consensual agreement is the ideal. And we realised as we went through the process how important that actually would be. And we saw how in some cases agreement had been reached, and in surprising places. We knew, as most people know, that more truth might help if agreement is to be reached, particularly truth from the big players. By the big players, I mean the British and Irish governments. I mean the army and the police and the paramilitary organisations, those kind of big players in the situation. And the truth is important because it does two things for us. First of all, it dispels myths of goodness. And both of us live with myths. Both nationalists and unionists, republicans and loyalists, live with myths of goodness. And the truth could dispel some of those myths that sustain us in our separateness. But the truth would also dispel the myths, some of the myths, about evil doing, particularly evil doing with intent. Sometimes bad things happened which weren't intended. Sometimes bad things happened which were intended. And some truth would help maybe just to split that up a little bit. So we tried to address that development of more consensual agreement across society by proposing a thematic strand within the commission which would look at the broader themes of the Troubles, which, well, the first thing that probably comes to people's minds there is collusion. So to look, rather than looking at individual cases, this is one of the complaints, by the way, that we heard about the Historical Inquiries team, that they looked at every individual situation and they didn't connect them. So even if you were, for example, looking at, let's say they were looking at the Le Mans bombing, they would look at each individual person who died and how they died, but they wouldn't look at Le Mans as a kind of overall package, how it all happens and all of that. So we thought the thematic strand was very important for that. So the collusion would be in there. How did collusion work? What is collusion? All of that. But people could bring things to the thematic strand, or they could be identified as they were investigated. So it could be anything from the IRA border campaign. This is one of the things that for the Unionist Loyalist community in the border areas, it's extremely important. They believe I'm from up there. We believe that there was a concerted campaign to shift Protestants away from the border areas. Is that true? Is that not true? That's one of those big themes that might be looked into. And again, things like Bloody Friday as a whole big event. So anything could really end up in the thematic strand. And my personal view is that if you'll probably ask me at the end if I think it's going to happen or not. I have no idea. I could swing from one hour to the next, but the thematic strand might be the least likely to happen because it actually requires a bit of proactivity from people to get it into the thematic strand or to request that something be looked at. So I don't know. We then tried to reflect a little bit for ourselves on what the conflict was and what the past is. We had to try to find a language which we could all live with, and I mean which we could all live with, not which we could all 100% sign up to. And I suppose the way in which we tried to find that language was for us a way of modelling the desire to move into a future together. In other words, all of us were prepared to make a sacrifice around a definition of the conflict for ourselves as we worked, or a definition of the past as we worked. The past means, of course, different things to different people. For some people, it's the 40 years of the Troubles. For some other set of people, it'll be the last 200 years. For some other set of people, it'll be the last 800 years. And so the past and what the conflict was about, and in fact what the conflict was at all, is something that we have no agreement on across this society. What there is, what I think we can say with confidence, is that the past is not something that is gone. But our brief defined us as a group to the last 40 years, the years of the Troubles. But we still wanted to say, and did say so in the report, and I hope said it clearly enough, that we wanted to be open to stories beyond the 40 years. And that was partly important for us to say, partly because we didn't want to be perceived as government poodles. So we felt it was very important for us to say that. Listening is key in reassessing and agreeing the past. And we knew that, and again we have tried to deal with that within the society strand by emphasising the storytelling aspect and the remembering aspect of our lives. But all of that storytelling, listening, reassessing the past, while it needs to be examined, it also needs to be framed in a way that will take us to a future and not embed us in the past. Having said that, it just needs to be happening, and the society strand was to do that. Remembrance is about reconciliation, truth, and forgiveness. Perhaps one of the most contentious things that I think we said in the report, which has just totally gone without comment, and maybe because we found it very difficult to wrestle with even as a notion and therefore to communicate, and it was this, that the past can be changed. I found that extremely difficult to hear when we began to talk about it. And we returned to that conversation, I don't know how often, for a whole year. And while we ultimately got the philosophy of it, we weren't sure if it was a good thing to say or not, but ultimately we wanted to say it. The past can be changed for this reason, because it now only exists in your mind. Therefore, when you manage to look at it from a different place or to hear it in a different way, it changes somewhat because it's only there anyway. Now that's hard, I think, and I find it very difficult to swallow, but I thought it was an important point for us to make, and we as a group felt it was important. It's not that radical in many ways because it's already happening. People are already changing their view of the past as they listen to each other. Myth and mystery can sustain a lie. So too can fear and hopelessness. But there's always new light when clashing myth and clashing mystery meet. And they're framed in a different way then. Overseen, of course, and directed and focused to the future. But they clash, they meet, and things change. Ultimately, we were looking towards a society in which we would be able to attribute one another with basic human dignity. which in Christian terms is to say that we are all made in the image of God, even when you or I have done inhumane things, we're still made in the image of God. From my kind of Christian roots, we'd have described it as, God loves you, I have to love you too. And that was the bottom line on it. All of that then, this clashing myth and mystery and this attributing basic human dignity to one another takes us down the road of forgiveness and into reconciliation. Okay, I'm going to just do some personal reflections, and then I'm near the end, okay? As a kind of reflection on us as a society, I think I would want to say, or feel the need to say, or be bold enough maybe to say, that we are wedded to bitterness in a way that we have not yet acknowledged. Now, most of the time, and for most of us, standing in pulpits, sitting in pews, wherever we find ourselves, we don't feel bitter. But when it comes to the hard cut, there's a bitterness in us, and there's a bitterness in this society that we have not yet managed to divorce ourselves from. And there needs to be divorce proceedings. That bitterness is identity shaping. Even if it's not at the top of our being, it's still making us who we are. And it feeds our political leaders, and it feeds them in a way that means they're not able to reframe our politics. And I have to say that's not entirely their fault, because they have a constituency of people they depend on, and they have to depend on them. That's their bread and butter. But it constrains them at the top as well. So as an expression of dignity, we had suggested that there might be some signing of a declaration that we will never again kill or injure others on political grounds. Some within the group would have liked a much stronger declaration than that. They would have liked a peace covenant that everyone in Northern Ireland would have signed up to. Not that we would never kill or injure others on political grounds again, but that we would never kill or injure others on any grounds again. Olive, you'd have been happy. But we couldn't agree that in the group, because we knew we couldn't agree it out there. Just wars and all that kind of thing. But at least as an expression of dignity, we would allow other people to make their declaration, and we would be prepared to express our own dignity alongside them by making our own declarations. As you would expect, the consultation process, things fell out along the normal community lines, justice on one side, truth on another, all of that kind of thing. The consultation process was harrowing because of the depth of the hurt and the emotion that's out there, and the response is urgently needed to that, very urgently needed. We were disappointed in terms of some who didn't come to participate in the consultation process, by some who wouldn't come, or by some who did come just to look okay, but who wouldn't engage properly with the process, because really they believed it was nothing to do with them. The thing that impressed us maybe most of all was the amount of work that is being done. There is a huge, huge amount of work being done by people like yourselves. And the reconciliation industry has been an industry that has held us together in many ways, but which needs to again coordinate and revitalise itself probably. Everyone we met desired a better future. The consensus of the whole process was that we don't want it to happen again. The question, of course, is what are any of us prepared to do in order for it never to happen again? As we are now a number of months after the launch and after the process, it's always interesting to note how swiftly public debate moves on. That's public life. I do wonder if our unwillingness to face the past is actually an unwillingness to face ourselves. And I suppose as I finish, I would want to say that I remain, and I amaze myself in this, totally committed to what we proposed. And that surprises me, I suppose. So I'll stop.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Leslie. Terry has a question.
Terry may well have retired.
Not so.
Leslie, in your first of your personal reflections, you spoke about the whole question of
being wedded to bitterness.
The bitterness. Really, what I was wanting to ask you was, is that bitterness being perpetuated within the communities from generation to generation?
Yes, we have a bit about that in the report as well, because that was one of the things that would have been communicated to us in the consultation process, you know, very sharply, that there was a great concern about this intergenerational stuff. And not only in terms of the bitterness moving from one generation to another, but also in terms of the impact of the trauma, of the troubles moving from one generation to another. So we were hearing stories of young people who weren't even born when the Good Friday Agreement was signed, or the Belfast Agreement, whatever you want to call it, and yet who felt the trauma of a relative being killed because the family repeated the story often, bore the pain within their family situation in a way that it impacted on the next generation. So down the generations, the experience of the troubles is certainly not going away. And that too would be something that would need to be addressed, not only in terms of educating young people, but also in responding to whatever their emotional needs might be.
And there's just a follow-up question. Is that possible in light of the fact that our communities are becoming more segregated? What are the possibilities of actually addressing the need for education within those communities?
Well, clearly, responding to the trauma of any generation, or providing education within any generation, can be done in terms of just where they're at. So it doesn't mean, because our communities are further apart, perhaps, or more segregated, however you want to describe it, because it doesn't mean nothing can be done because of that. There's lots that can and should be done. I think one of the difficulties is that we depended on the troubles to bring in the money, and sometimes to bring in the vision that was needed to address many of those things. And in a post-conflict situation, we are weary. We all have some degree of trauma reaction, whether we know it or not, and therefore both the will and the vision, I think, to address these things in a cross or inter-community way is maybe a bit more limited. But that doesn't mean nothing can be done.
Harry Smith, Christian Neuro Center. I'm probably one of those people who struggled and toyed with the possibility of going to the commission and listening to you now, perhaps maybe I would rather not, but I can't reverse that. I've grappled with this, probably you know, for many, many years over the issues of the troubles, you couldn't live at the centre or not. And particularly with the spiritual dynamics of it. I don't know whether they actually, you know, grappled with that. And this is one of the reasons probably why I didn't even go to the commission, was that I find it very difficult to speak into a secular sociological dynamic about the mystical side of our faith. But I mean, like Paul says, be angry and sin not, and don't let the sun go down in your anger. Don't give the devil a foothold. It's very difficult for people inside the church to understand that, I find, never mind outside of it. But, you know, sharing it purely at a person-to-person level, if my wife and I have an argument and we don't sort it out, it just isn't us having an argument. Paul says we actually give the devil a foothold into our relationship. So there's something spiritual goes on there. If we move that from the micro to the macro, you know, as I shared in that book that I wrote, that of the three main Protestant churches caused a quarter of a million men to sign a covenant that has been perpetuated and it's taking down through nearly 100 years now. My feeling would be that we need to have a recognition and acknowledgement of that wrong back in 1912. Just as a husband and wife can only be truly reconciled when they realise the hurt that I have caused towards my wife by me asking her to forgive and she saying sorry. Oh, I can only accept from what Paul is saying that I remove the spiritual foothold the devil has in our relationship. So if we move that from the micro to macro, what would happen if the Protestant churches of today acknowledged the sin and the wrong of our forefathers and repented of that? What happens in the spiritual realm? And I say that's a difficult one for me to try and articulate in a socio-political environment. But I feel it's one that's important, and it's one certainly that they recognise in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
The Dutch Reformed Church, who had a similar covenant to the Ulster covenant,
mm-hmm.
repented of it. And the key players in reconciliation there felt that while they've still got the fruit of all of those years of apartheid, they nonetheless made a transition peacefully. And they felt that recognition and acknowledgement of a wrong covenant was a very, very important factor. I'm just throwing that out there because I'm aware that there's a spiritual dynamic and all that goes on, that there's first and foremost in Ireland, before it's orange versus green or Catholic versus Protestant or nationalist versus unionist, that it's a spiritual battle of Satan against the kingdom purposes of God for Ireland. And we don't bring that into the equation. We're always only looking for socio-political things without actually acknowledging that there is a spiritual something
sure.
that are underlying it. And the church doesn't seem to be very, very good at addressing that.
No. I just for other reasons, this last few weeks have been thinking about this whole business of the devil getting a foothold and what it means to be attacked by the enemy and at what point you blame the enemy and all of this kind of thing. It's really a stupid reason why I've been thinking about it, but I'll tell you why. We have American volunteers and they're not the enemy. I had sent them something to download to show on the screens before a prayer the other Sunday morning, and it was this lovely piece. Liz showed it in White House and got it right, and it could have led us into prayer beautifully, but they downloaded the wrong thing. So we had this thing, and when I sat down, I can't see the screen, so I'm imagining everybody seeing this lovely thing. And they're seeing this thing that says, "Hello, God, is there anybody there?" Silence. And this goes on, and then ultimately it came to this bit, which said, at this point I'd moved my books to the side to see what was going on. "You know from experience that God is imaginary. There's no point in praying." And I thought, flip, what is this about? And I was kind of mouthing down to the back, what is this? And I thought, well, they must have watched it, so there has to be a good punchline, I'll not say anything. So it kept on, and it finished by saying, "And then you go to the hospital, and you get diagnosed with cancer, and you're told you have to have chemotherapy, and you're told you're going to be on the table for 8 hours surgery, and you go home and you pray, and you were right all along, God is imaginary. There is no answer to prayer. Please visit www.godisimaginary.com. And I had to stand up and say, "Let us pray." It was like, what? So I really wasn't the better of it for about a fortnight. But the way the volunteers explained what had happened to me was that we were doing very well and we should expect attacks from the enemy. And I thought, jeepers, such a palaver of lack of responsibility, taking responsibility. So I began to think about what you're saying, in fact, and I think in secular terms what you're saying is that people need to take responsibility for themselves. Okay, so there's nothing wrong with saying that. I think one of the reasons the churches ain't too good at that is because when we move into that kind of spiritual dimension and talk about it in that very spiritual kind of way. We could get into the what the American volunteers did, which was, well, that was the enemy, it wasn't us. So we still find that we're not able to take responsibility for ourselves in the most theological way, or biblical way, or spiritual way that we can. One of the things that we found, Harry, throughout the process, and particularly one of the things I found most disappointing, and I've said it on more than one occasion, is the fact that people didn't come in and say, this is what we need to do. I don't think anybody came through the door and said, this is what we need to do.
I understand.
And the churches especially didn't come in and say, there are some things maybe we could do. And that meant that we couldn't actually, at this point, that's one of the things for the future. There was no point in us saying, people need to go and take responsibility for themselves. So we got into the acknowledgement stuff a little bit. There were some groups that we found, as we talked things through with them, who, surprising groups, who might well have been prepared to take responsibility for some things they did in a public way. And by that I mean some of the security services and some of the terrorist organisations. But by and large, people weren't willing to take responsibility for what they'd done or what they'd contributed. And we therefore felt that that would be better reflected on at the end of the Legacy Commission process, rather than at the beginning of it, because it's something that people have to come to rather than be told to do. We also hope that through the Day of Reflection and its development, and as that would be discussed at the Reconciliation Forum or wherever, that some of that might begin to work itself out there too, particularly if room were made for this signing of a declaration thing, that people could begin to, in a more public way, take responsibility for what they had contributed, whether ever they got down to the Solemn League and Covenant or whatever it might have been, would be another matter, but to stand up and say we did or we didn't would be a step forward. Now if you say that to most people, like if I go back and say that to other Presbyterians, they'll say, but we did say, and the General Assembly did say, and the General Assembly may well have said, but the likelihood of people hearing it who needed to hear it is probably limited. So it's not just about saying, it's also about being heard. So I don't have any difficulty with what you're saying.
A lot of people do.
Yep.
A couple of points there, so many issues raised. But one is... there's a sectarian problem in our society, as you recognise. I think there's also a very deep racist problem. The racism being anti-Britishness and anti-Irishness. And the two are interconnected. And that wasn't mentioned in your report. And secondly, it's as you talk about being involved in the process. And maybe that's it, because I took a view, right or wrongly, that I felt that there's been a lack of honesty in the way the past has been dealt with to date. And I felt that your group was to bring that certain honesty to the way it's been dealt with. I think, first of all, it needed to create a moral basis for how we deal with the past. And I don't think you managed to do that, because there was wrong done. There was wrong done on all sides. But that had to be stated loud and clear. I don't think that came out of the document. In some respects, it nearly tried to be an equivalence between the various groups involved. But as you talk about a process, I wonder really if it is a process, then really what our society needed to deal with was what it wanted to do with the past. Did it want to investigate it fully and bring out the truth and bring out justice? Or did it want to say, we have got a position 10 years after the agreement where so the fall of war or conflict has started to clear. We've looked at the future, we've looked at the past, and there are certain decisions that we maybe have to take now, very hard decisions, in order to free up the future. And so do we try and, where possible, draw a line under that past, not forget about it. And storytelling, I think, is one very powerful, and I hope Brendan here is a very big supporter of that.
one powerful way that we understand better what happened in our society and what happened to others. But is it maybe that you moved too far ahead and that you needed to ask that question of our society first? What do you want to do? Do you want to investigate the past? Do you want to find out all the truth? Or do you want to draw a line under, not forget about it, but draw a line under and to enable the society to move on, park it for a period of time, to give society time to heal? Because you talk of themes, you know, if I gave you a theme like Martin McGuinness, what, you know, that theme in itself, what effect would that have on the political process that we hope, or most of us hope, a lot of us hope does succeed, difficult as it is for us to accept some of the things, to accept some of the things that are going on. And I can give you one example where I'm talking to Martin McGuinness, asking him to do something, he's saying to me he won't do it. And 2 days earlier I'm talking to my father about a person who Martin McGuinness was either directly or indirectly responsible for killing. But pragmatically, morally, or whatever, I took a decision, I'm going to make this work for my children because it's an opportunity to move to somewhere different. Now, right, that's rightly or wrongly my decision. But I think an awful lot of people in our society have actually taken that decision. People who have suffered terribly, who aren't vocal, and we hear many vocal survivors or victims groups, but we don't hear the many others, and the vast majority of those, who don't or who aren't vocal. And we keep that silence that enables our society to actually to move on. And I think in some ways, and maybe as you talk tonight, it became clear, maybe you yourself, as a group, should have seen this as a process and moved that process to a stage where you got an answer from the population, what do you want to do, and give them that choice. Because if it is a matter that they want to investigate the future, and they want to investigate the past, and they want to pursue truth and pursue justice, then they're, you know, endless number of ways you can do that, but understand the consequences of that too, and the fact that you find out you have your Nuremberg trials, which we haven't had, so you're potentially pursuing the Indians without pursuing the chiefs. You have the money launderers, people who helped, assisted those who were carrying out the various things in the past. The other truth of what went on here is, it's devastating. And neighbours, you set up neighbours. That real reality that we've managed to sort of deal with to some extent because we don't actually know the truth. We suspect that we don't know. And I wonder, did you just move the process too far by not setting down very clearly, first of all, the moral basis for what we're trying to do and what went on, that wrong was done, and what's saying we have to find a way of moving on, and then asking society, what do you want to do? And then, once you've got that answer, then look at the ways to deal with whatever society says we need to do.
Okay.
It's a caring issue as well, and a racist issue. Could you not recognise that, or what?
That we would understand that to be your analysis, right? So our analysis was in terms of the sectarianism, so that's a whole analysis thing that we weren't dealing with, okay?
But let me
answer the other things.
And don't mean to, you know, in discussions, you know, with Republican prisoners, you know, the comments made, the campaigns were driving the British into the sea, you know, it's, you don't see a sectarian, you see an anti-British, and, you know, so it's not my analysis, it's what was said.
It's your analysis of what you heard. We didn't make the same analysis, okay?
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
Okay.
In terms of our task was to find consensus. What you have outlined is precisely what we did in the consultation process, which was to sit down and say to people, and what do you want to do with the past? And what we're telling you at the end of our consultation process is that there is no consensus in this society about what we want to do with the past. Some people want truth, largely from the Republican community. And we went back to them and we said, and some of the meetings were very hairy, we went back to them and we said, you realise if you get the truth, that this is what it could mean. It could mean that your son, whom you mourn, is exposed as a British agent, and you will never again be welcome in your community. Is that what you want, where you want this truth thing to go? Yes, that's where we want this truth thing to go. We want the truth. Right? Then there were others who wanted the justice thing, whether it be the Nuremberg style or the our inquiry style or whatever, they wanted justice to run its course. And we went back to them and we said, you realise where this will end up? This will end up with, we suspect, the review of 500 potentially criminal convictions, where people will be found to be, have been convicted unsoundly, as in Danny Morrison's case. That's all still ahead of us if we just allow that to run. Do you realise that you'll go through the public inquiry system and there'll be judicial review after judicial review and there'll be black line after black line put through documentation? You will know no more at the end than you knew at the beginning, but you will have gone through a most rigorous, intense and devastating process. Is that what you want to happen? That's what we want to happen. So we had all those hard discussions. There was no consensus around what people wanted to do with the past. The only consensus was around the fact that nobody wants it ever to happen again. So what we had to then try to do, because if there had been any other kind of consensus, we'd have gone a kind of different way. What we then had to do was to attempt to satisfy some of the needs that were out there, while providing what we thought was quite a rigorous moral backbone to it, which is this whole business of dignifying one another with human, with.
So what you've decided is people don't want to draw a line under the past.
Some people do.
No.
But not everybody does.
The consequences of your report, as you said, we're not drawing a line under the past. What we're going to do is we're going to investigate the past.
Well, okay. What we said, some people wanted to draw a line under the past, right?
No. But the consequences of your report.
What we decided was.
You decided. It's not about drawing a line. We're not drawing a line under the past. And we're all stakeholders in this society.
Yes.
You know, and victims are widespread.
Yes.
And there are many different victims. And survivors, I think, as many as survive. But basically your group said, right, we've decided we're not drawing a line under the past. We now want to investigate.
What we actually said was, how we said it in the report, what we actually said was, there is too much of the past in this society. There are some things that need to be done in order to enable people to bring the past to a close. The quickest and most effective way that we can see to bring it to a close is a 5-year legacy commission. That's what we said.
Sam Lamont, retired police officer, working for the Retired Police Officers Association.
Yep.
What consideration is given to the additional trauma that would be brought to retired police officers brought out of retirement to address the Legacy Commission for the next 5 years, where they're not going to get paid for their work? We've already had situations, Rosemary Nelson inquiry,
yep,
where retired officers are giving hours upon hours of their personal time and getting no recompense for them. So what the trauma that just people having to bring back memories from years and years ago. Some of the senior officers dealt with maybe 100 murders, and they're going to have to go back through that in their mind.
Yep.
And we're already in the situation where we have maybe 250 new cases being reported to the psychology department.
Yep. Absolutely.
Each year. So what consideration was given to retired police officers?
Long and hard consideration, and that's partly... Partly it was a very significant influence on why we argue for a 5-year commission. There are some legal processes that can't be wound up that quickly. We can't just say, stop it now. So there are things that have to, inquiries that have begun that have to run their course, and some other things that have to be brought to a close, and there has to be some derogation from Europe and legislation in Westminster, and all of that takes a certain amount of time. If we had had no consideration at all for people like the retired police officers, then we would not have proposed the 5 years. We would have allowed things to run as they are. The 5 years was the best we could do at giving some consideration to people who wanted other things, as well as consideration to people who didn't want this to go on and on and on till they were completely broken. So it was very influential, actually. I think one of the things that was very difficult from the angle of the police inputs that we had, and not all of them, some of them obviously, was that while arguing vigorously for the kind of standard police position, they then, many of them off the record, would have said to us, I wish we could have just called this a war and it could have been over by now. Now, if only that had been on the record, we could have handled things quicker. But we couldn't deal with what wasn't put on our table.
Just to clarify, the retired peace officer's position is either investigative civilian or throw a line on it. But the halfway measures, they didn't feel work.
There was only one way to draw a line under it quickly, and that was to define it as a war.
Yeah. No, I don't agree with that. I don't think you ever agree with what it was.
You do. I'm telling you, Trevor, that from the perspective, we went to the LCJ, we went to the legal advisors in Europe, we went to the legal advisors in Britain, we went to the legal advisors in Ireland, and we asked, was there any other way to do it? And this is the only legal way it could be done. We looked at it.
Then we're caught with that.
Yes, we are caught with that. And when we were caught with that,
then we should just investigate and deal with it. And whatever comes out.
But that's, I mean, our worry was that that was going to go on for 10 generations.
Cheryl?
Yeah, Philip, sorry.
There's a very interesting Australian historian who investigated the stories from the First World War from different veterans. And he interviewed them at different stages in their life. And he also found out about their social background during that period. And he found, first of all, that their memories of their experience of the trauma of the war, and they were in the trenches, right? So it was traumatic. Their memories changed as they got older. Their memories varied according to how successful their life had been and how much they had a sense of the future in their lives. So, for example, if they'd lost their job, their family had fallen apart, the whole memory and trauma of the war was much, much different than if their life had been in a successful period. And it ties in, I think, with what you're saying about the future is the past and the past is the future. You know, that the past is something that we carry with us rather than really existing any longer. And I think, for me, you know, the way we can change things is by envisaging more and more of a positive future for everybody. You know, it's what we do in terms of social and economic work to create a better future that can move us away from. Maybe that sounds simplistic, but I just love that image. That analysis that historian came up with. But can I just give another wee anecdote, if you don't mind? I was interviewing a chap who was a young fellow from the New Lodge 2 weeks ago, and during the Troubles/War, whatever you want to call it, he showed me how his arm had been almost completely damaged and destroyed by a UVF bomb under a car that his friend had. He'd been going to work with his friend anyway. This bomb had caused great trauma to him, physically. And he said, I haven't told my children what has actually happened. I told my children as they were growing up that a shark bit me. He says, when they get old enough, I will, if they really ask me, then I will tell them. But until then, I don't want to give them any more reasons to hit the person who killed or nearly tried to kill their dad or the community that seemed to harbour them. He said, there's enough people breastfeeding their children reasons for hate. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was a very powerful analysis, you know, powerful anecdote from him, but shock. You know, there's sometimes, because a story's true, is not a reason for it to be told. Sometimes it needs replaced by an enchanted narrative of some sort. And I suppose, as Christians, we feel the ultimate enchanted narrative is the gospel. But if that isn't too idealistic, I think, you know, it's quite a powerful image.
That's one of the problems that I have. I've dealt with a man who received information from the historical inquiries team about his father's death, which caused him so much trauma he had to get psychological help. You know, and before the inquiry, an inquiry didn't turn him up.
Nope.
You know, so it was a waste of time, really, quite apart from the fact of causing a lot of problems.
Truth will not come through inquiries.
Patrick Troughton, an ordinary individual with a family in South Africa, The one major thing that had peace in South Africa was so many people forgave. I don't see very much forgiveness here. I think that's one of the big problems why this is dragging on. I can still remember stories about my grandfather in the Republic 100 years ago saying there was a problem with the religious side, which is nobody ever forgives. I think that's one of the big problems. Am I right?
That's fair, yeah. I mean, we were afraid to touch forgiveness, hardly at all.
Yeah.
Did you have experience?
One of the problems again is that, you know, I was talking to one of the Anglican bishops just a few weeks back, and, you know, I was asking him about, because he was actually one of the people who encouraged me to write in the group, heating up my bit, and I said, how are things going? And he said, well, we're hardly touching it. And I said, are you aware, and I thought this from other people from the inside, that the cross and paramilitaries are on a very high level of preparedness to celebrate 2012. Mm-hmm. I said, are you prepared that in 3 years' time, not only the Church of Ireland, but all of the main Protestant churches who were involved in 1912 are going to be having services all over the north of Ireland to commemorate this thing. And actually all that they're doing is stirring up and strengthening the spirit behind it. And he said, actually, I haven't. I said, well, you've got a 3-year window, or else that's just what this is going to
happen. Yep.
And that would be the reality, is that we will actually be perpetuating that at a church level. We will be endorsing that at a church leadership level, what happened back then, and all the things that have flowed out of that. And, you know, I'm just pointing out, as you say, all it is just stirring up the hate and the divisions. We should be giving a lead in the whole issue of ownership, of repentance and reconciliation. And it doesn't seem to me that the leadership of the church is given that lead. And that's a constant challenge that I put right to them, you know. I know many, many ministers we have in the Red Mount group in person who repented of it. And at times I think it's shaken them. Because if you personally felt it was wrong, and the ownership you've had 3 generations on from what your grandfather did, if it was wrong for you, is it not wrong for your church? And if it's wrong for your church that you're a minister of, why aren't you sticking your head above the parapet of all the other ministers that I know have personally felt that it was wrong and want to distance themselves from it? I'm not getting those sorts of answers. I'm not saying that the satanic is the answer for everything, but all I know is that there's a spiritual principle in there that we can actually do something that has a very, very powerful effect, potentially a very powerful effect, in the heavenly realms of where we stand, as it was in certain. It's a challenge that I'm not getting a lot of answers from the hierarchy, the governing bodies of any of the three churches. And the Methodist Church is taken to. But there's a 3-year window there, and I think it's a very, very serious window.
There's one last question there, maybe.
One last question?
You had a line about the past. I can't remember what it was. Something about the past can be changed. Is that it?
Yeah.
Yes. The past can be an empty chair. Two things. Did you ever feel in all your harrowing experiences that it was almost presumptuous to be on the commission? And second, third, did you ever feel that the reconciliation industry, as you call it, can sometimes make people feel guilty because they're hurt?
Yeah, I was always aware that no matter how harrowing the experience of listening to people's stories can be, that it bore no comparison to how harrowing the person's actual experience was. I mean, I was always extremely conscious of that. That if it feels this hard for us, how must it feel for them who day and daily, as you say, look at the empty chair? Always conscious of that. Always. What was the second thing you said? Sorry, the other thing.
Did you ever feel presumptuous to be sitting as part of a quango or?
Yeah, absolutely.
To be sitting there at the top table, I mean, I'm thinking, I wasn't present at the meeting in Ballymena, but somebody I know of, evangelical, seriously grasping for justice because of what happened to his brother and his workmates at Tyrone Crossroads, and not getting any answers himself. So did it ever feel as if you were at the top table there, and he were you, or he was a legitimate player, he was the most badly ever? And yep. What about people who just say, leave me alone, I just want to be letting this out the rest of the days?
In my own way.
It's the only way I can cope with it.
Yeah. So part of the difficulty with the consultation process is that you have to take account of your consultees. But as you say, there's a myriad of people out there who aren't among your consultees precisely because they want left alone and they want to get on with their lives. And in some ways, if those people could have found a way to put that message on our table, that would really have helped us. Now, we were conscious of it, and all of us know people, or new people and still know people, who simply want to get on with their lives, who don't want to be public about their suffering, who don't want to bear their soul to anybody. And we tried always to keep that in our heads as we went through our conversations. But if there was only some way in a consultation process that the people like that could make their voice heard, and I don't know how you do that. I'm only saying that's part of the way things are. In terms of who am I at this table, absolutely. I was at the Ballymena meeting. It was a shockingly bad meeting. It was a shockingly difficult meeting to prepare for because we had anticipated that it was, and had received information that it would be hijacked by a certain political party who would demonstrate, etc., etc., etc. So everybody was tense going into the meeting. It wasn't hijacked in the way that we had anticipated it, but it was hijacked in other ways by people who spoke. It was a bit like a bad meeting of the General Assembly for any of you Presbyterians.
Yeah, it's not
funny. No, I don't mean that, but in the sense that some people talk too long.
Yeah.
And that's what Presbyterians do when they don't want to hear another opinion. They talk too long themselves. We were aware, sitting at the top, that there were the people who were talking too long who were simply being political. There were people who were talking but needed answers. There were people who couldn't get a word in edgeways who needed answers. There were people with an entirely different opinion to any that were being expressed who were afraid to get out of their seat and say anything. And somehow you have to try to manage that, and nobody, and I mean nobody, is up to the task.
Well, there's the very machinery of this whole thing. An obstacle to get in the way.
The
machinery of the industry, if you call it.
The reconciliation industry.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't have called the consultative group on the past part of the machinery of the reconciliation industry. By that, I really meant, by the reconciliation industry, I meant the kind of ad hoc groups that exist or who have come into being because they want to address the issue of reconciliation. I meant groups like this. I didn't really see us as part of the reconciliation industry. Maybe I should have. I hadn't thought of that. I suppose from time to time one can be quite cynical about the reconciliation industry and the way in which people have made a living out of it. Having said that, when you've sat through all that we sat through, there is a realisation that without people trying to put society together in different ways, it mightn't even be as good as it is. And as good as it is, mightn't be that great for some people, you know.
I'm very conscious that we could probably continue talking all evening, and there is an opportunity for tea and coffee, and you can continue talking to each other for a reasonable time anyway, at least until I kick you out, or go to sleep under a table somewhere. So please do feel free to continue wrestling with the questions. I mean, I'm so encouraged that there are so many people here. In some ways, maybe there should be 300 here, do you know, because we can't just put the questions away of how we're going to deal with each other's pain and the past and how we're going to carry it forward. And yet, we do need this kind of conversation to be listening to each other and trying to understand the big picture of why can't they do this, and why did they have to do that, and, you know, maybe together, maybe prayerfully, I mean, I don't know what the way forward is, but I hope that as we continue to have conversations with each other, and each one with your own relationship with your God, with each other, I do hope that we can find a future that can look to the future and not simply live out of the evils of the past. So, although I hadn't planned to, I was wondering, would it be okay if I pray to simply entrust this as part of a process into the hands of one who's greater? God, you have created each one to reflect who you are. And so as we listen to each other, we are on holy ground because you are present, and we want to honour you in the way that we treat each other. And it's so complex living in community with people who are hurt, whom we have hurt, or whom those in some sort of responsibility or authority over us have hurt. And we ourselves have been hurt. And Lord, we don't know how to face the future and how to live together in peace, learning to love and respect each other for your sake, learning to bring healing and grace and mercy and peace, as well as justice and truth. Lord, we thank you for those who have laid themselves bare to share their pain or to hear the pain of others, to try and bring healing, to try and find a way forward. We thank you for the agreement that we don't want to go back. It must never happen again. Lord, we are helpless to know what the way forward is, how to make a constructive way forward that we can all agree on. And we need you, your Holy Spirit, to give us a desire for your fellowship of peace and shalom. So we entrust ourselves and each other and our community, fractured as we are, into your nail-pierced hands. And we ask you to give us your spirit of wisdom and humility and love and courage to live in this place, to bring honor to you and wholeness to your people. In Jesus Christ's name we pray. Amen. Can we give say a big thank you to Leslie Carroll? And please do help yourself to tea and coffee and cookies and chat to each other.